from the department to see the representative from media, see there are also people from the diplomatic community, you're welcome, and there could be a few other people whom we have invited, you're all welcome. This is our first meeting of the Portfolio Committee for Energy in this year 2011. Compliments to everyone, Unyago Musha. I trust everyone has been able to re-energize, because we've got a very tough and an intensive year ahead, not only for the energy sector, but also we need energy for the elections around the corner. We also need energy for COP17, which we will be heavily embroiled in. I'm sure we all share one thing. There's been a flurry of articles and public discourse on climate change issues, which integrate, amongst other things, energy. And in that way, I'm sure the committee will be engaged and seized with all and sundry. I trust everyone has got the agenda. Can I just propose, we have three items there. The first one is actually the update on the IRP2 public hearings, which the department will give. The second is the adoption of the committee program for the first term. And the third is consideration of the committee's annual report for last year, that is 2010. Can I propose we withdraw the second item, because I've just had a brief discussion with the department on found that they have a few inputs to make that definitely tempers now with the program. I really appeal for that, because we have to take into account their inputs, and I really hope that when we meet again in the next meeting, we will definitely adopt the program for the first term. If that's the case, thanks very much. But first things first, as we all know, towards the end of last year, there were quite a number of not just changes, but dramatic changes, both within the executive, which had an impact to Parliament as well. I then trust we'll all be happy that we do some introduction before we proceed with our deliberations today. My name is Sisanji Gelana, the new chair of the committee. I've been an alternate member in the past, and I was a full-time member within the committee for trade and industry. I will then humbly request the rest of the members to introduce themselves.
Eric Lucas, member of the committee.
Thank you very much. Without wasting any time, can you then hand over to the department to make a presentation on the RP2 update. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I can just quickly also make the introduction. My name is Nedisa Mokubane. I'm the Director General for the Department of Energy. And I'm being accompanied by Mr. Omvi Apane, who is the acting DDG for Electricity, Clean and Nuclear Energy. And from the Office of the Minister, I have Mr. Archie Lucas, and who is the Minister's advisor. And also from the Deputy Minister.
Sis Nelly, you are a bit fast.
Oh.
We need to attach the names to the faces.
Oh, okay.
We'll be working with these human beings forever and amen, so we need to know them.
Okay.
First then from the first.
Okay, all right. Okay, maybe let us do the talking. Go
ahead. My name is Omvi Apane, and I'm going to be doing the presentation.
Omolimo Lucas, Minister's Advisor.
And Chair, if I can also table the Minister's apology, who is accompanying the President at the World Economic Forum in Davos.
Can I attend an apology for Mr. Serge Matav? He will not be present today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Guevo, are there any other apologies that have been submitted? Honorable Moss has just submitted her apology. And Honorable Dexter will be late. We haven't received any other apologies. We've noted the apologies from both ministers. We trust and hope they will be with us in the next meeting. Can I just set some practice from the very onset? I trust quite a number of people who are here will be with us from time to time. One of the things that has been made very clear to us as new chairs that within this table we will only allow members of parliament and the other requisite people whom we have invited, which is the department. Any other person, I just appeal, cannot be part of this table. I will allow Mr. Guevo to just ensure that he's done. Yes. Anyone else, only in the table, will be members of Parliament and the department. Thank you. Okay. Over to you, Sisney.
Thanks again, Chairperson. I would like just to do a recap the integrated resource plan. Members will recall that the department was charged with ensuring that we develop a plan that is going to meet specifically our electricity needs for the next 20 years. And these electricity needs must also take into consideration our climate change imperatives. That includes, amongst others, reducing our emissions quite significantly, taking into consideration that we have been listed as one of the largest emitters per capita in this country and in the world. Now, what has happened to date? is that the IRP was developed, and what we did in the development of the IRP was to say, this is going to be our input. In other words, these are the assumptions we're making, and then we had to develop a plan and then present the results of the plan and provide that to Cabinet for Cabinet to do its assessment if it meets with all the government department's policies. Now, what happened was in June 2010, we presented to this committee the input. In other words, to say, these are the assumptions that we are making. Please provide input in those assumptions. And assumptions were provided. And again, we went back to work, and then we produced the first draft of the integrated resource plan. And from that first draft of this integrated resource plan, we published again for people to comment. We also took it to NEDLAC for it to receive more input. So today we are planning then therefore to present what was tabled for public comment at this stage before we take it again to Cabinet for approval. So Mr. Apane is just going to be taking us through the presentation of how far we have gone, where we are to date, and probably also just give us a sense of what kind of comments and inputs we have received to date. Thank you very much.
Honorable Chairman and honorable members, good morning. I don't know if the mic... I don't think the mic works well.
Yeah.
I might just have to shout. Firstly, to apologize about the format of the presentation. It's going to be a little bit tricky. It would have been much better if you could do an overhead presentation, but I presume you'll be able to follow from the handout. And so secondly, to also indicate that that those that might have been through the presentation before, please bear with us because we will be taking some of the, we'll be retracing some of the steps that the DG has indicated. We firmly believe that to arrive at an integrated resource plan, we had to go through a very rigorous and perhaps sometimes painful stakeholder engagement process. Now,
I was just saying that we have gone through a very rigorous stakeholder engagement process at different stages of this integrated resource plan process. We are now at the point where we are collating the input from the last part of the stakeholder engagement process. So we will be taking the committee into, or rather taking the committee through some of the engagements that we have had since the last time that we came to the committee. You will remember that we came to the committee at that point when we were still dealing with the assumptions. And as the DG indicates, we have had a number of engagements with stakeholders, both public and also through some of the legislative institutions like NEDLAC that we have to go through. So I'm not going to go into some detail beyond what I've just said around the background and assume that we're now taking it from where we left the last time. Just to also recap is to indicate that the IRP is a subset of the Integrated Energy Plan. In other words, it is part of a bigger plan which is currently under development and we are aware that there would be issues around the timing and positioning of the plans relative to each other, that perhaps the integrated energy plan needed to have been developed before we could get to the IRP. So please bear with us, because there are specific issues that we are addressing in the integrated resource plan that then made it necessary for us to proceed with it rather than wait for the IRP, for the integrated energy plan to proceed. Now, it answers specific questions in the electricity space in relation to South Africa's energy requirements. In the past, very briefly, you might recall, one of the problems that we had was that the state utility ESCOM made all of these decisions outside of any policy framework, and it made it difficult to determine what South Africa's policy imperatives would be in such a vacuum. We're wanting to ensure that we also meet those policy objectives. The DG has alluded to climate change, but there's also a very serious matter of supply adequacy. You might be aware in 2008 we had a problem balancing supply and demand, and there were blackouts. We also have a deliberate program around creating local jobs through manufacturing and localization kind of issues. In the context, we also wanting to ensure that we optimize the use of our local and regional resources. In other words, as opposed to us being about 90% coal-fired or fossil-fired power station domination, we're wanting to diversify, but at the same time integrate into the neighboring countries as well in terms of the resources that we want to take advantage of. We have the cheapest electricity tariff in the world. It presents certain competitive advantages. It's got some disadvantages as well, but we're wanting to control that space rather than let it be determined outside of a government policy framework. We say that an energy plan in the context of the IRP will have a certain impact on our water situation. There are issues around water shortages in this country, the issues around skills, the issues around land, and also the issues around our coal, endowment. We have vast resources of coal. So the plan needs to take all of these things into account. But there's also the issue about the respective roles of the players. ESCOM, as we indicated, government, the regulator, private generators, and other stakeholders, as to who plays what role. The issue of funding is also a very critical one. We are sitting a few months after coming out of a very difficult process of defining a funding model for ESCOM, and that has a direct impact on the future electricity tariffs and our competitiveness as a country in the global arena. And those issues are taken into consideration in the development of the IRP. There are also issues around certain commitments that have to be made, perhaps in the short to medium term, particularly in relation to keeping the lights on. So this IRP has to address that. I mean, there's no point in us defining a plan which only starts taking effect in 5 years' time, and yet we have an immediate problem. So we address that. I don't think we will dwell into too much detail around that, but this is what is called the medium-term risk mitigation plan. But perhaps lastly, to indicate that when we develop the IRP, we do not do this with a particular end in mind. Right? So in other words, it's not like we have certain preconceived positions that we want. There are policy issues that government has defined, but the IRP is actually a very clearly defined process, which hopefully you should be able to replicate if you follow the same process. It is fact-based, and it is premised on achieving or determining the most cost-effective mix of generation options, given certain constraints that would impose on this. It's a modeling platform, so in other words, a piece of software, it's called Plexos R, that can easily be procured. It's not like a proprietary or anything like that. Anybody can replicate it. We emphasize this point because sometimes people want to, you know, predetermine some of the outcomes. How this model works is that we put assumptions in, and through some stochastic process, the Plexos software chooses the least cost portfolio over a period of time in order to balance electricity supply and demand. And obviously, electricity demand is a big input. In other words, what demand forecast you put in there becomes a very delicate parameter, if you like. What we then do is that based on the modeling of certain scenarios, we would do what is called risk adjustment. And risk adjustment or policy adjustment relates to us then putting certain constraints in. As an example, we would say we would like to limit emissions in line with the LTMS or in line with the commitments that were made in Copenhagen and so on. So that's how we would do the risk adjustment. But beyond that, or apart from that, it's purely a technical process that a model, or rather, a modeling tool assists us in doing. I have alluded, and sorry, I'm on slide number 8, I have alluded to the fact that the IRP needs to be responsive to what happens in the short term, and that we address that separately as part of our medium-term risk mitigation process. And if I can refer you to that slide number 7, in fact, it's not, it's the one just before, I think slide number 8 is numbered. Right. In terms of that slide number 7, we're saying that there is an urgent need to stabilize the system right now. You would have known, you would have noticed last week or 2 weeks ago that Eskom were making some indication about supply, demand, supply and demand as we speak. And there are specific issues that we think we can introduce in order to keep business going, so to speak. You can see that around 20, if you look at that graph around 2011, which is this financially, which is this year, we, in relation to our demand forecast, supply and demand match. But then, between 20, shall we say, just after 2011, up to about 2014, 2015, we have that dip where the red line goes underneath the blue line, which means now our demand will be more than our capacity to meet the demand. The medium-term risk mitigation plan then introduces specific interventions, particularly those interventions that can be achieved in the short term, like energy efficiency, like certain renewable energy programs, like cogeneration, and so forth. And those short-term interventions are not necessarily going to be covered in a lot of detail in the integrated resource plan. So we will be looking at the period beyond the integrated, beyond the medium term. In other words, the assumption here is that there is a separate process to take care of balancing supply and demand now up to around 2015, but then beyond that, the IRP options start kicking in. I think we have taken some questions around the implementation of the IRP and this question around when do we start putting all of those options in place has become very critical to answer. Now, going back to the IRP itself, is that we're saying there are a number of competing
criteria or options, not options, but parameters that we need to balance. The IRP has to make sure that on the basis of the demand that we have put in as a forecast, we are able to put in place a plan that balances affordability, balances supply adequacy, in other words, keep the lights on, but also takes care of some of these externalities like water, like greenhouse gas emissions. And the point about this slide on number 8 is that, by and large, some stakeholders want to push one criteria or parameter more than the other. Right? The issue of affordability, for example. If we look at the externalities, as a country, we could get to a point where we deal with certain externalities or assumptions around certain externalities in a manner that does not make it affordable in the immediate term for us. Right? And when we say affordable, we know it's also a subjective issue. But in the short term, in other words, in terms of being able to pay for it now, those are some of the issues that we seek to balance. This point is also very important, and I know it's a bit controversial, because by and large, people talk about, you know, affordability in the broader context when you take those externalities into consideration. We say that on this particular one, there are certain commitments or sacrifices around employment in particular that South Africa as a developing country is not in a position to make to the extent that certain even more developed countries out there are hesitant to make. And the point about that also is that, remember, in Copenhagen, some of the commitments that we made were conditional upon certain things being in place for us to be able to move that way. I'm not going to dwell on slide number 9 because that's the one that I explained in some detail about the process of the IRP. Suffice to say that we have defined 3 consultation points. What we are doing now is giving the committee feedback around consultation point number 3. So in other words, we came at that point of at point number 2 to the committee, and now we're closing the loop and saying that we are now giving you some feedback around consultation point number 3, and apologies to those that have already had the benefit. If you go back to the stakeholder engagement process, Chair, is that we indicated that we had 81 submissions on 830-odd specific inputs. This is around the assumptions that we had proposed, the data sheets that were circulated and so on. And we're not going to dwell too much on that because we gave you feedback that most of the responses were received from the NGO and civil society sector, academics, and also industry and business. To also indicate, as the DG has already alluded, that we took advantage of the other platforms that were required to engage on, like NEDLAG, that we ran a parallel process as we did the stakeholder, the public engagement, and we formally tabled the IRP process and its deliberation at the NEDLAG platform. Very briefly, an overwhelming number of responses were around renewable energy generation, particularly around some of the assumptions that we were making there. And I can take you back and give some detail. It's particularly around the pricing of renewable energy options that most inputs were received, but it was also around how people were forecasting that their renewable energy technologies are going to decline in capital cost, but not only that they would decline, but how they would decline as well. And as you can see there, it ranged all the way down to water issues, the fact that South Africa is a water-constrained country, and perhaps in the integrated resource plan, we did not
pay particular attention to that shortage of water. Maybe to also indicate at this point that at the same time there was another stream of consultation, which is the intergovernmental process with the different government departments. So basically, this IRP was taken through a very rigorous intergovernmental consultation process as well with National Treasury, the Department of Economic Development, Water, Environment, Science and Technology, and so on, yeah, Trade and Industry, and so on. So it has been a very, if you like, multi-pronged consultation process at different platforms. And we are now at that point where we're quite confident that we, you know, we might disagree about some of the issues and agree on others, but just in terms of putting it out to the public, we have done that. I'm not going to dwell too much on slide number 13 because, Chair, as indicated, the comments that were received at that point related to the fact that, for the first time, the government had shown its, if you like, its good faith in consultation or in attempting to put in place a rigorous consultation process. And I'm saying attempting because there were some issues around the extent to which that process of consultation could be improved. You know, that we do the consultation in the metropolitan areas. We also do the consultation in the metropolitan areas. Largely, we do the consultation in English and perhaps, you know, broader public engagement could be had if we translated some of the deliberations into other languages and also had a more representative, perhaps provincial, stakeholder engagement issue. Timing, or the time allowed for the consultation process, Chair, we were criticized because initially it was felt that we were going too quickly, but just to demonstrate some of the compromises that we also made, we had intended that by November last year we would have had the IRP promulgated, and we had given an extension of time regarding stakeholder comments. It even went all the way to the Deputy President, and we were given a very clear instruction that we had to extend that final leg of the consultation, and that's why we're sitting here in February, and I will just give you some detail around the latest developments, you know, that have not made it possible for us to conclude the IRP in the time that we had originally anticipated. So, Chair, the point about this is that we believe that we have really, you know, gone out of our way to engage within the limitations of the time constraints that we have. Just to refresh your minds around the major themes, in other words, most of the comments that were received indicated renewable energy, but I mean, broadly, it's the whole notion around the low carbon economy and the need for us to introduce more renewable energy into the mix. And Chet, some stakeholders had this position around us having to increase the renewable energy contribution to between 20% and 75% by 2050. Chet, I'm not going to mention names, but there are positions like that that says that, you know, South Africa in 40 years' time needs to be 75% renewable energy generation, and it's doable, and so on, as a position. There is also a very clear, you know, stakeholder group that does not want to have any nuclear or coal in the mix in the future as a specific position. And then the issue around funding generally or financing these different options that we introduce in the IRP as a specific driver, that financing
have to take into account, the options that we make have to take into account the viability of for financing. And the example of the Medupi financing process with the World Bank was raised. And then the issue about costs, I have alluded to the cost, the capital costs and so on of renewable energy technologies. I'm not going to go into the detail. Perhaps one of the things that was also very clear from the that stood out from the consultation was that we needed to take into account possible new technologies, excuse me, in the future. For example, the fact that we might be able to generate electricity from very, if you like, new technologies that we are not aware of. So as we plan over that 20-year horizon, we needed to deal with that possibility. And then the issue of the market itself, the structure of the electricity market, and basically it's around the fact that we have a vertically integrated monopoly, Eskom, and in the context that we need to introduce independent power producers, how does that impact the integrated resource plan? With some indication that perhaps we needed to have an electricity market like they have in Western Europe and other jurisdictions. There was a big category of inputs that were a little bit confused or confusing in the context of the process that we're following. In other words, where we were saying this process is input driven, the inputs go into a model and then the output. But some comments that we received seemed to want to produce the outcomes instead of saying this is what, you know, so to bypass the model as it were. There was a little bit of a difficulty about discriminating between, you know, what constitutes an input, an outcome, and in some instances, policy, you know, that as you can imagine, where people believe that certain policy needs to be put in place, they would suggest that this is how it needs to be done, irrespective that there was a policy that was contrary to that, that position, or in other instances where new policy was being suggested, you know, they used the IRP platform as that kind of opportunity. I have mentioned the issue around water specific. Maybe to also indicate that there was a sense also, maybe along the same lines as my previous comment, there was a sense that a lot of expectation was put in the IRP to address all the energy problems. In other words, it was like, you know, this IRP will deal with distribution issues, you know, electrification, you know, the poor, and all of those kinds of, if you like, issues that go along with an energy plan. And we had specifically indicated that this IRP is focused on a specific aspect, and down the line, it might well be developed to cover the rest of the other issues. Incidentally, perhaps to also indicate, Chair, that the IRP 2010 will be promulgated, and it covers a 20-year period, but it is not cast in stone, so there will be a periodic review of the IRP in order to change it as and when the assumptions prove incorrect. So we made that point about us needing to not forget that, and that this is only a starting point. The issue about socioeconomic impacts of the decisions that would be made in the IRP came out very strongly, and I can indicate, well, maybe I'll do that in the conclusion, that the, this is a particular issue that we took to heart very, very seriously, and as such, some work was immediately commenced to do the economic modeling of the particular plan that we're proposing. Externality is a very, shall we say, controversial issue. Not so much that it was not taken into account and that it
which should be taken into account, but more around the fact, around how you deal with the externalities, because there is not a uniform approach to dealing with the cost or the impact of coal-related diseases in the economy in a uniform way. So the different approaches and so on, and the extent that, or to the extent that we had not addressed that, was presenting some problems. I have alluded to the issue of if you like, non-energy related parameters, but which would be impacted by energy. For example, the Human Development Index, there was a sense that, you know, we produce a plan, but what does that mean for the general population out there in terms of, you know, improving, amongst others, the Gini coefficient, you know, and other such issues that relate to human development. We have specifically excluded distribution and transmission in this IRP. We deal with them in a particular way, given the complexities around it. And as I indicated, the IRP is focused on supply demand rather than trying to address the rest of the other elements in the plan. And there was very, very, if you like, detailed submissions around transmission and distribution and how we need to deal with it. And then the last point around perhaps the opportunity cost on climate change, that if we did not take it too seriously in the IRP, then we would be creating a legacy that would cost the country a lot. What we then did with all of these inputs, Chair, is that, first of all of these inputs, like 800 odd of them, have been captured and they have been put on a database. And we were deliberately careful about this one, because there was a sense from some quarters that they would send comments and we would not even, you know, capture them. And there were examples I can indicate where somebody said, my comment was not captured, and we were able to say, who are you? Give us your details, and then went into the database and showed them that, you know, their comment had indeed been put on that list that is in the database. I think the difference here being that sometimes there was confusion around comments being captured and whether there was agreement around it, and in some instances, you know, people wanted to take advantage of the fact that I had said we need to do this and the other, and why are you not doing it? And that manifested as my comment was not captured. So that's the first thing, Chair. We have a database that's available, so we can go back and indicate each and every one of the written comments that we have received, you know, in a manner that can be audited and so on. This proved very painful in that round of consultation. Chair, maybe I can jump the gun and indicate that in the last round of consultations, we received about 5,000 comments. Right? 5,000 comments, which by the end of this week, we would have completed in terms of capturing them in the list. And this has been happening for the past 3 to 4 weeks, right, over the Christmas break as well. So that's the extent of the information that we're receiving there. But we're very careful, Chair, about having to deal with those inputs in a particular way. We then, at that point, analyzed those parameters and attempted to provide a response. So on the database, for example, you will see over and above, this is what somebody said, right, a response. And the response could be anything from noted, right, or this has been taken into account in this particular way, or sorry, this does not add value to the process, particularly where it's just unconstructive criticism, because we receive a lot of that. Chair, I must indicate that there's a lot of that as well, where people just I suppose don't like this whole philosophy at all. It's almost like we are on the wrong track altogether, and it becomes very difficult to respond to such criticism.
Okay, Chair, if I move on to the to slide 18, specifically around wind and renewable and other renewable energy technologies. Chair, most of the comments that we received were around this particular matter, and it was quite critical for us to deal with it in a particular way, particularly the wind technologies and assumptions that we would make around it in the base case. In other words, in the most basic of the scenarios. And for wind, we indicate that we use a certain technology. In other words, this impacts the cost that we put in around renewable energy. And there had been specific requests that we must indicate the assumptions to the extent that we have indicated here, so that people can go back and model the same assumptions in order to test whether they come to the same output. Just in terms of scenarios versus plans, and I'm sure, Chair, we're more we're clearer around this particular issue because it created havoc at the beginning, that in some instances people thought that a scenario was the plan, right? Because we had indicated that we're modeling a spectrum of scenarios, and the scenarios range from business as usual, which is least cost, coal dominated, all the way up to no greenhouse gas emissions, no new greenhouse gas emissions. Gas emissions would be, you know, everything from only renewable energy to renewable energy and nuclear. And in between, the millions of permutations. We'll go into some detail as to the specific scenarios that we have modeled. But I can also indicate at this point that even that was not enough, because I think we gave in to stakeholder, if you like, the stakeholder push for us to model additional scenarios, the two specific scenarios that we had to model. I can indicate that we have modeled a scenario based on no nuclear energy, and this will be completed next by the middle of next week. I'm already going to the conclusion to give you a sense of where we are as well. But there was some confusion around what we meant by a scenario, and people felt that, you know, they had the luxury of suggesting that why don't you put an extra 5,000 megawatts of renewable energy, whereas that is an outcome or an output, right? Where it should start is where we say we're wanting to have the following criteria, right, satisfied. Cost, supply adequacy, which is keeping the lights on. We must keep the emissions below a certain a threshold. And then what does the model choose in relation to that? As opposed to let's choose something and it doesn't really matter about cost and whatever. So the point here, Chair, is that we try to clarify that, and hopefully we have made some progress in relation to that. There was also another issue that we needed to make a decision around, Chair, at that point, was that there was some sense that we needed to model the economic impact of each and every one of those scenarios, right? And we resisted that because of the time and issue. So basically it was like, you know, we will reduce the scenarios into a plan, and only the plan will be a model from an economic impact perspective, rather than each and every one of those millions of permutations. Okay, I have mentioned some of the issues that we wanted to balance in the triangle, but over and above that, is that specifically from a government policy perspective, is that we're very conscious of the impact of the plan on tariffs, so we look at that closely. Carbon emissions, it has become even more critical recently, the issue of regional development, particularly to take advantage of the clean energy options in neighboring countries, in SADC and so on. The imperative to diversify the generation mix, in other words, to ensure that we not only reliant on coal for power generation, but we look at other options, and not only on the supply side, but also to look at
energy efficiency and other demand side options. Time frames is a very critical issue, Chair, and we need to emphasize this one. We started by indicating that we have a live problem in this country, which is supply and demand is not in tune, and we need to make decisions that require licensing. The IRP is a legislated instrument in the Electricity Regulation Act in terms of which the regulator makes licensing decisions. In the absence of an IRP, the regulator would find it impossible to make those licensing decisions. And the extent to which we could go around in a consultation loop and delay the promulgation of the IRP would impact the implementation of some of those options that we would propose. And as such, we needed to find some or to strike some balance between taking the IRP consultation process at, you know, to its extremes instead of, or in relation to making sure that we do have some plan that can at least keep the lights on. Some of the scenarios, Chair, and I'm just now giving some detail around that, is that we looked at a number of demand scenarios. There has been some, I can indicate, Chair, that there has been some controversy around demand forecasting. As you might appreciate, you know, nobody can foretell the future as accurately as that. And demand forecasting was heavily criticized. There was some sense that perhaps we were over-forecasting the electricity demand. So there is a sense in some quarters that we had pushed the demand more than it really should be. At the same time, Chair, and I'm sure you will hear about it at some point, is that there was some sense that perhaps it was certain energy-intensive industry that was driving the demand more, and consequently we needed to deal with that matter by, and to be quite frank, by closing smelters and so on. So this is a matter that we had to deal with. We have done demand forecasting on the back of a specific forecast that ESCOM itself does, and ESCOM does that, ESCOM system operations does the demand forecast, have been doing this over the years, and you can check for yourself the extent to which their forecasting has aligned with the reality. And then there's also been another alternative that we had looked at because of the criticism that this was just an ESCOM view of life, that the CSIR forecast was also taken into account. I'm not going to dwell on the supply side options, except that we looked at all technologies, basically. It's almost like all manner of fossil-fired cogeneration and renewable energy options were looked at. In the forecasting, the economic outlook plays a specific role, or rather has a particular impact. And you will see in the forecasting there is a cone of there's a range, there's a sensitivity around some of these parameters that have been tested. In other words, almost like a high, middle, and a low road in terms of the demand forecasting and perhaps the impact of those. Climate change, we must indicate that our climate change scenarios were premised on government's own LTMS, right? The LTMS, and I'm sure you're familiar with the LTMS, but it's the long-term mitigation scenarios. That is our point of departure, that perhaps in the absence, and this is something that we were, you know, specifically confronted with, that in the absence of a specific or clear government policy on climate change, which is currently being developed, we would use the LTMS as our point of reference. But obviously we did model some of the other scenarios based on, for example, testing the Copenhagen conditional commitment. and then regional integration and take advantage of the neighboring countries is something that we looked at as well. I'm going to dwell on the renewable energy. Maybe on the assumptions in biomass is that we had, you know, the biomass for cogeneration, but also for generation of through renewable energy is a specific issue that the manner in which we dealt with the cost was a little bit controversial, and we received specific representations from the sugar and the paper industry as to how to deal with that. But we had then made assumptions based on a specific a case that had been made by Tongat itself. And then we dealt with the matter of pump storage. The context here is that pump storage is a peaking technology which would at some in some instances compete with open cycle gas turbines, and which would also have an impact on wind. So the extent to which we wanted to be clear that the model would choose either pump storage or wind or open cycle gas turbines was a specific issue we needed to, that we dealt with. Very, very quickly, just the scenarios, and Chair, mindful of the time, just the scenarios. Our point of departure, remember, said that there is a spectrum, is always the reference case. The reference case is what happens if South Africa were to just build the cheapest option available to us, more and more coal-fired power stations, even beyond Pusina. And then we take it from there. Firstly, we look at the scenario that involves constraining the emissions, and we constrain the emissions along LTMS lines, if you like. Then we look at another scenario that models certain levels of carbon taxes. Then we look at a scenario that looks at diversifying the generation mix. We look at the risk adjustment scenario in terms of which we would, you know, introduce certain non-ESCOM generation. We also force certain milestones in terms of decision making and so on. Now, in terms of the decision making as a function of the or as an outcome of the modeling exercise, we indicated that the debt triangle looks at costs, it looks at externalities, but it also looks at all times keeping the lights on, and we call that supply adequacy rather than security of supply. We call that supply adequacy. So the model will throw out any option that does not keep the lights on. Right? So irrespective that the cost might be acceptable and that we have dealt with greenhouse gas emissions, if there is any doubt from a system operator point of view that, you know, there is a risk that we will not meet supply and demand at all times, then that option is specifically thrown out. And I think this point needs to be appreciated even more, because you have a lot of suggestions around how we can keep the lights by relying on, you know, untested models. And to be frank, it's primarily around the extent to which we can put a lot of wind in the country in order to displace some of the other options. And maybe to give to do justice to this one is that we have completed a study in terms of which what is referred to as the capacity credit in relation to wind in specific areas of the country, you know, was assessed, you know, in a very scientific way. And we have a sense now as to what the limitations are on the system in terms of relying on those particular options. I'm not going to go in detail around the critical criteria for selecting that. Once you have modeled all of these scenarios, one of the biggest controversies was how did we apply certain selection criteria in order to optimize the portfolio or the planning itself, and we indicate the sum of those issues then. The cost, supply adequacy, the climate change issue, in other words, emissions, whether it integrates into the system, into the SADC region, the issue of financing requirements, whether it's viable or not, and also local economic impact. Must also indicate that some of these criteria are very easy to quantify, yet others are perhaps more qualitative than can be quantified. And as such, you know, it created a certain controversy around how you ultimately determine that you know, this is better than the other. And we always indicated that ultimately government reserves that right. Okay, now, Chair, this is the tricky part now, because we also have from slide number 26 onward a rehash of the outcomes of the modeling process. And if I can just perhaps summarize that by indicating that we modeled those, if you like, categories of scenarios based on emissions, based on the reference case, based on the carbon tax, and so on. So I'm not going to, it becomes very difficult without an overhead projector to show that. But maybe to just dwell on what we refer to as the balanced scenario, which is the one, and I must apologize, that this is on slide number 29, the one with the heading balanced scenario. Then, what emerged from this modeling exercise is that in the period beyond 2014, which is more or less when we think that Medupi power station would be built, up to 2018, when we think that Kusile power station would be completed. And by the way, let me take a step back and say that our assumption or our point of departure is that Medupi and Kusile are hardwired decisions. So in other words, we cannot wish them away. They are a reality. They are currently under construction, so we take it from there. With all their, if you like, their implications on the some of the criteria that we take it. So we say, let's constrain the emissions along the lines of Copenhagen, right, which is like 220 with the conditional requirement, 220 megatons per annum of carbon by that time in emissions level 3. And I'll give you some detail around some of the outcomes. And if you like, a softer constraint, which is the 275 megatons. And what is emerging is that, firstly, in the 275 megaton emissions constraint, in other words, if South Africa has to go to that level of emissions in the time that we prescribe, right, it is clear that we will not be able to meet that without building nuclear power stations. Right? So, to be clear, the model chooses nuclear as the option if we are going to constrain the emissions to 275 megatons by that time. But the model also chooses renewable energy. Right? So let's be clear, it's not like we're saying only nuclear, but it's saying in 2022 or thereabouts, when 2024, when you decommission Hendrina, Camden and those power stations, the only viable option to keep emissions in check is to build nuclear side by side with renewable energy. And in fact, it gets even worse. If you go 220 megatons a la Copenhagen, then you build more nuclear. You build more renewable energy. And Honorable Chair, this was the most controversial issue, to the extent that I had, or as I indicated, is that there was a sense that we must force that nuclear out. So irrespective that the model had chosen nuclear, we must develop another scenario that we must model based on no nuclear. Right? So
to what extent can we replace that nuclear with more renewable energy. And that's what I'm saying that we will have completed by the middle of next week to the end of next week. And then, Chair, just some of the checks, if you like. How do each of these scenarios pan out, so to speak, based on criteria like price, and so on. Let me start with price, is that in the context of narrow financial costs, right? Let's be clear about that as well. We're not talking about, you know, taking into account the externalities. If we were to say, let's apply financial considerations to these scenarios, right? What would be the impact on the tariff? As expected, the reference case, in other words, where we build more and more coal-fired power stations, performed the best in relation to price, right? So if you imagine the triangle that we're trying to balance, it scores the highest when it comes to price, and as expected, again, the one that relates to emission level number 3, in other words, with a lot of, with 220 megaton, with a lot of constraint on the carbon emissions, is the most expensive. We look at a particular outcome, if you like, an output, a criterion called reserve margin, and perhaps a little bit carefully because it gets misinterpreted around what reserve margin means. But we were indicating that, again, as expected, your reserve margin will go to around 70% if we were to constrain. At peak, it will go to above 70% if we were to constrain the carbon. In other words, the amount of capacity that you would have to build in emission scenarios with nuclear, right, would make the reserve margin go to 70%, which means you would have 70% of capacity insurance, if that makes sense. Right? So you would have to build 70% more than what would actually be dispatched. Right? It's almost like you would have to have, you know, 15 extra buses because one of these buses would not be available, or most of these buses would not be available at the time that you want to take the students to school, something like that. Right? Now, it can also be a little bit misleading because it creates this sense that we're trying to show that it is not the appropriate thing to do. But in the context of the parameters that we check, reserve margin is one of the indicators. It's not the only, but it is one of the indicators around supply adequacy, because if the reserve margin, you know, the corollary is not true. In other words, if the reserve margin falls below a certain threshold, you definitely will suffer blackouts. Whereas if the reserve margin, you know, is above a certain level, it's almost like you're building more than what you require. So I won't dwell into a lot more detail around that. In terms of the emissions, as expected, the performance, you know, or the output in relation to the modeling, you know, worked exactly like we expected. So, for example, emission level 3 did indicate a profile that completely eliminated reduced the emissions to 220 megatons by 2020. You know, so the if you look at how the modeling is done, it's almost like it gives the satisfaction that the modeling does indeed respond to those constraints that would have been said. And as expected, also, that the coal scenario, the one that I indicated was the cheapest scenario, would push our emissions well below each and every one of the other scenarios. So would perhaps, relative to where we are now, would perhaps it's almost like a doubling of emissions if we build more and more power stations. I have touched on the issue of reserve margin.
We did reflect on the issue of funding of the integrated resource plan. Chair, it also indicated that perhaps one of the issues that stakeholders indicated we're not dealing with adequately in the plan was how to implement it. And implementation of the plan can only be viably done if funding is put in place or is available. And there is, I think, consensus that ESCOM alone will not be able to build all of the options that are indicated in the integrated resource plan, and that some of the plants have to be built by the private sector, in terms of which we transfer the risk away from government. And if we also, some of the considerations around funding is that if we are going to include nuclear in the portfolio, then government would have to come to the party with the funding. So we consider that as well, because it becomes a little bit tricky to attempt to fund nuclear from the private sector as an IPP, so if I can put it that way. Not as in the private sector cannot participate. Okay, some of the considerations in relation to the generation mix around renewable energy is the land requirements for it. And I know that we got heavily criticized on this particular one, that perhaps renewable energy did not require as much land. But our experience is that particularly for those prospective developers who have approached municipalities for the usage of land for power generation purposes, it created a specific dilemma for us as government. In other words, land use, it's almost like the argument in the energy versus food space, where the dilemma is around whether you would allocate land for this particular purpose rather than for the other. And in this instance, it was not such a problem in those areas that were typically, you know, remote and not arable land and so on. But the implications on land, particularly state-owned land, was a specific policy issue that we needed to deal with. Whereas on the other side, there was an argument around the fact that some of these other technology options, in other words, to try and mitigate the greenhouse gas emissions and introducing nuclear in the space of coal, that it would require relatively less land, and how do you then deal with that?
Mr. Apane, your value voice is
fading away.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm about to conclude, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay. Just some of the issues around nuclear, apart from the land, is also that we are expecting that around that time that we propose that nuclear might be considered as an option, that the global supply chain would be a serious consideration. There are a lot of considerations to build nuclear power stations by other countries, and as such, it might make it difficult to assume that the order book would allow us to build the nuclear in the time that is required. Then the issue around renewable energy also is around the example from Spain. Perhaps Spain and Germany, but to also learn what happens when you try and do renewable energy and you get it very wrong. We are alive to some of the lessons that the Spanish, or the hard lessons that the Spanish are still trying to recover from even today. And then the issue of making the IRP operational. And Chair, I have alluded to this point, is that the IRP is not an operational plan, right? So the IRP is just saying, this is what we might have to do to balance the supply and demand. But the hard fact is that the system operator needs to be able, right, to make sure that on a daily basis, the lights keep burning on. And as such, what does that mean from a production perspective? The difficulty is that obviously you would have to run some statistical models to determine what the risks are and so on, because you can't really dispatch all of these options in the portfolio. You can't dispatch wind, you can't dispatch solar, and so on. But what does that mean if you have a big portfolio of those in the thing? So behind the scenes, there is a process to try and deal with the operational viability of any plan that we put together. Chair, slide number 38, if I can take you to that one, I have dealt with the issue of price. Slide number 38 was to also reflect on one of the issues that we perhaps controversially are alive to, and this is the issue of South Africa's competitiveness in the context of its electricity price, and I did allude to that. Then, if we look at what the price impact will be of the integrated resource plan, right, South Africa's electricity tariffs would move in a particular direction. And where does that put us relative to certain countries? Some of the criticism is that we need to compare apples with apples in terms of the countries. I mean, we reflect that India, Kazakhstan, and China. Are those the right proxies to be comparing ourselves to as countries? But secondly is that we need to be comparing, you know, the right tariff on both sides of the country. But having recognized those weaknesses, we were saying that if you look at South Africa, which is in the blue, we might, you know, find ourselves in a situation where if we're not careful, you know, the electricity tariff impacts our competitiveness in the context of the existing industry. I'm not talking in the context of, you know, what could be. In the context of us being a very heavy, what do they call it, mineral energy industrial complex, that competitive, a resource-based economy, you know, that's the point from which we were departing, and we understand that there is a lot of sides to that. I'm not going to go into the slide on the next one because it does more or less the same thing. What is very clear, though, is that the IRP will apply upward pressure on the electricity tariff. Right? So the tariff is going to rise. Our electricity pricing policy prescribes that the electricity tariff must increase to the long-run marginal cost within the next 5 years. Right? And if we're going to build the power stations as indicated or introduce the options in the IRP, you know, our tariff is certainly going to rise to some level, and we do some comparison, or we need to do some comparison with our, if you like, trading partners and competitors in the global economy, and so on. Just to indicate that in the socio-economic impact modeling process that we are doing, we reflect on some of these issues in a lot more detail. So it's not like we're suggesting that we have dealt with it here, but we're just saying we're flagging it as an issue that we're taking into account. But what about carbon? And I'm almost there, Chen. What about carbon? We're saying that South Africa's legacy, right, in the context of our structural nature of the economy, is such that we are very carbon intensive. Right? And we then compare what would happen to our carbon intensity based on those scenarios that we have modeled. For example, what happens if we were to continue on a coal-based, coal-dominated scenario, and our carbon intensity does not reduce in that scenario, in that trajectory, if you like. But obviously, if we were to go to the low-carbon scenario, then, in other words, stop building any coal-fired power stations that are not carbon capture and that are not CCS ready, carbon capture and storage ready, then we would be able to reduce our emissions on a certain kind of trajectory. And then we also reflect on what would happen in the context of the emissions themselves. So in other words, carbon intensity is one issue, but also the absolute emissions, as already indicated. Water,
is that the indication is that if we continue building more and more coal-fired power stations, which is on slide 43, the blue graph, we will definitely have a peaking in the amount of water consumption or requirement by around 2020-21. Right? And obviously, we must check that against our resource base. And that reduces, perhaps because we will be decommissioning more and more of the older power stations and building newer and more efficient coal-fired power stations. So in relative terms, we would reduce our water usage. But definitely, if we were to go the low-carbon scenario, it would give us the most responsiveness to water usage very quickly, but also without introducing a peak around 2021. If we take a step back, Chair, we did indicate that we have also tried to balance the scenario based on certain criteria. The interesting thing here is that in relation to water, the middle ground is provided by this scenario, that you can reduce your water consumption, right, by building Medupi and Kusile, by building renewable energy, by introducing nuclear as proposed in the balance scenario, and then get to a less water-intensive position than using coal-fired, even though it will be more than in the low-carbon scenario. And then the cost, sorry, I wanted to come back to the issue. Just to maybe round off those three criteria, which is affordability, which is price, and affordability in the context of financial issues, in other words, financing it, and then price itself or tariff, and then carbon. And we're saying that we have to balance that on slide number 42. The low carbon scenario represents the best performance in terms of carbon emissions, yet it is the most expensive in relation to narrow financial costs. Right? So in other words, excluding impacts and all of those other externalities, in absolute financial cost, it is the most expensive without a doubt. On the opposite end of that spectrum is the blue bubble, which is coal-fired power stations, relatively cheap, but perhaps not addressing the carbon emissions issue. And somewhere in between, we believe that lies the answer, and that's why we're proposing the one that the green bubble, where the emissions would come down drastically. In fact, we think that the emissions at that point would even be half of where we find ourselves now, without necessarily incurring additional costs. And the numbers there are relative, so basically we're saying that relative to the low carbon, or relative to the low cost scenario, coal as required, if you were to build no coal-fired power stations and on go on the 220 megawatts, you would have to build an additional 22,000 megawatts of capacity. In other words, it's that same argument about the reserve margin increasing by 70 plus percent. So you need to build 20,000 more megawatts of renewable energy capacity if you are going to achieve the same level of supply adequacy and so on. And this is where the additional costs come in. So now to just conclude around where we find ourselves, I've mentioned the issue around cost. I'm not going to go in there except to say that this is not business as usual, because we recognize our obligation to protect the environment. So it's not like we're suggesting that, you know, narrow financial costs are going to determine where we go. Growth and job creation is a very serious consideration, and in the impacts we look at that quite carefully. So the argument about financial costs perhaps is counterbalanced by an argument that says maybe invest and pay the premium in order to create the necessary growth and so forth. Carbon, it is very clear that Copenhagen, we cannot afford. And we made it very clear, and that's why those conditions were made. But I think the modeling does indicate that just reinforces that issue, but that we can get to LTMS by 2025 and long-term mitigation scenarios is what we're referring to. If you recall the balance scenario, if you might have seen on the previous slide, the balance scenario does introduce a little bit of a peak, but then we would track back to where we want to be in relation to LTMS. What is it, peak?
Peak.
Okay. Very critical is the issue of supply adequacy. All of these scenarios that we've looked at keep the lights on. Right? So as a minimum, the model does not consider any option that does not keep the lights on. And we yet to get to a determination around some of the scenarios that we have proposed as to whether they also keep the lights on. Needless to say, we think the balance scenario is what we are proposing, and that's what we have proposed in the public consultation process as well. The issue around uncertainties is something that we must not forget. In other words, we have made a whole lot of assumptions initially, and as already indicated, because this is based on assumptions, as the assumptions say a change, we would have to go through this IRP planning process over and over and again. Some decisions have to be made. I alluded to the timelines that are critical and so on. We believe that it might not be possible to please everybody, but unfortunately, Chair, what it does is that we run the risk that we might displease everybody. And so we didn't please anybody, but we displeased everybody, and that's the choices that we have to make, or in relation to the choices that we have to make. We are alive to the growth, the economic growth constraint due to infrastructure largely, but also energy infrastructure in particular, and it's become critical to address that. Just in terms of where we find ourselves now, as I indicated, we have received from the second week of December last year, when we closed the public consultation process, we received 5,000 comments, which we, as I indicated, we have already started capturing. And Chair, we must apologize. Unfortunately, we're not at that point yet where we can say, you know, that these comments have adequately been captured, and this is, you know, an analysis of the issues. But they're very similar to what I have already alluded to earlier on in terms of the themes that came out today. I indicated that we are busy modeling a scenario based on no nuclear, as agreed during the stakeholder consultation process. And then the issue of the socioeconomic impact, Chair, it's a bit of a tricky one here, that we will not be able to produce the socioeconomic impact study at the same time that we conclude this IRP. We intend to have finished the comments and, if you like, the balance scenario by the end of February. Right, so within the next month and a week, we would have completed all of that, but the economic impact unfortunately comes after you have completed that, and as such, it pushes the dates out. We're wanting to take this plan, the integrated resource plan, to cabinet, and it would be at that point where we would have synthesized all the inputs in order to allow cabinet to make their final input as well, so that we can then get the green light to proceed and do the necessary adjustments and ultimately leading to promulgation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. We are actually done. We're simply just looking at an additional slide that says the balance scenario, what does it give us in terms of the pie? In other words, how much coal will that be by 2030? How much renewable energy will that be by 2030? How much nuclear will that be? So we're just going to just present that also quickly. The picture that we're hoping for doing this on an overhead on the overhead projector.
Are you winning?
Yeah,
okay. Or shall we break into a song? It is this last light that
yeah,
is left.
What the proposal is in the balance scenario, that it would by 2030, what it means is that we would have coal contribution of 48%, renewables of 16%, and then nuclear 14%, and then the balance would be a combination of imported hydro, gas, and pumped storage. Be about about 17% if the number study.
Sorry, 22%.
So it will be 48% coal, 16% renewable energy, 14% nuclear, and then 22% would be a combination of imported hydro, gas, and pump storage.
Done. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Abane. I'm sure we really have been concentrating for quite some time. Quite a number of things have been raised, and we definitely appreciate particularly the feedback on the comments and issues raised during the consultation process, and I trust members will definitely make inputs, questions and comments on that. Can I take the first round of questions? Just before that, can I just suggest, I see there's quite a large contingent of enthusiast supporters and promoters of energy, and apologies that we've run out of the presentation, but Mr. Gwebu will raise his hand, so that those who have not been able to get the documentation can make arrangements with him to get it. The Parliament has got to stay as transparent as is possible all the time. Honourable members, questions? Let's take the first round. I hope, if you don't mind, let's just give them the questions and then we'll take a 5-minute break so that they prepare themselves. Because we've been at it for some time now. Okay. Let me just start from this side. Honourable, all of you, you're just next to each other. Bunga. Ila.
Thank you, Chair. Apologies for just delay. I was just held up in another meeting in the office. My concern, man, I want to get a clear clarity. I didn't hear clearly whether Mr. Apane has just said this, that the RIP process, he never managed to receive comments from the rural communities. I just want to get it clear, because rural communities are one of the vulnerable communities that also need to be taken care of and to be taken through these processes so that they can be able to, get involved. I was astonished and impressed by your engagement yesterday on the media. When you said, you are able to engage with different departments, and especially of the cooperative governance, to ensure that you push the issue of saving energy and the solar water heaters. But when I see this, I tend to question your honesty yesterday. You must just clarify to me whether is it true that you couldn't get any feedback from the rural community, or you couldn't be able to engage with them. Because if I remember correctly, our engagement with you last year was that as you proceed with these consultings, you must ensure that you become much more relevant with languages. It doesn't matter how far does it go. I even make an example to say you can't find people that can speak Siswati or Shangano or whatever. You must be able to get relevant in terms of these people. If you can't get a translator, you must go extra, because the end is that these people that are so vulnerable, they must be able to be get engaged and to be informed about these issues. The other question goes to the issue of your database. I'm trying to check whether. Is it going to be available in terms of any website? Because you must be able to ensure that people that made those comments, some of them, they mustn't say, yeah, they say these comments are available, but where do you get them? Do I have to go to Pretoria to get the office so that I can access this database or what? I'm trying to check in terms of all your mode of resources that you've used in order to avail your database, so that people, they cannot say, yeah, my comment was not recognized, but this person has never, explored those resources that you provide. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My question is just related to renewable energy and nuclear. You made mention of the fact that there were some observers or commentators we're moving for a range of 20 to 75% to be supplied by 2050. My question is that not feasible, given that there might be advanced technologies by that stage? Let me flip it to the other side. I would want to establish also whether the debate around renewable energy being a base load in future, is that going to be realized, or there would still be a challenge of variable supply? My second question it relates to nuclear energy. I just want to establish the concerns that people had on nuclear energy. Is it predicated on concerns of safety, which are as a result of the first generation technologies, or of cost overruns, taking into consideration that some of the advanced technologies are reputed to be quite safe? And lastly, if you could, if you don't mind, just to combine those two questions with the remarks that were made by Nexen. I just skimmed through some of their submissions. They make a very interesting point of Denmark, where the west of Denmark uses Norwegian hydro, but the east of Denmark uses French nuclear power. And that they make a point here that not a single coal-fired power station in Denmark has been decommissioned due to the introduction of wind power. I just want you to combine the three and give us an elaborate response.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think we move from three mice here as representatives of public that we would like to see a scenario in which South Africa has electricity and where this electricity has no threat of blackouts and other matters. But equally, that the issues that have been raised to be taken care of in the process of achieving that by the consultations are implemented. But this question relating to rural electricity continues to play a vital role in our society, in the sense that places like Johannesburg, Camp Pretoria, which is now becoming one city, Durban, Cape Town, these areas do not have a problem of electricity in respect to shortage by way of infrastructure, but they may have shortage because they use a lot of electricity. They've got manufacturing areas and so forth. Last year when we discussed the issue relating to the rural electricity, part of what the department said was that it is, in some cases, there is no infrastructure at all, let alone consultation. In the presentations and in the plan and the scenarios, we do not clearly hear what the department plans to do with that area. I know the department itself will not do anything like that. Those electricity implementers and distributors like ESCOM, what they plan to do with that, because these are some of the questions we were asking one of the state-owned enterprises that has now been closed down, if we could get more information there. But much interesting is that our sense last year to China on engagement of different countries there worldwide around the issue of climate change. One of the issues that arose in that whole week meeting or conference or workshop, whatever you want to call it, was the issue of carbon storage and carbon trade as an option, which would then reduce the emission of carbon, instead store it somewhere and look at finding out whether we can be able to recycle and produce electricity out of it. What is the department take around that issue? And then the other issue that was raised much more sharply and has shown results, I think, in other countries, is the issue of using the waste in terms of trees that are cut, the lawns, the flowers that are dying, all this waste as an energy source. Do we have anything in mind in our plan as we go forward to try and look into those particular options, or to commission some studies to inform our generation mix as we move forward? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just in regard to the target of 16% for renewables. If we look at the total generating capacity of Eskom, which is 41,500 megawatts, and we look at the renewable assumptions for the base case, and we look at wind specifically, it shows 100,000 megawatts per year. Now, that is the main component of the renewable energy. I would say it regulates renewable energy down to nothing else but just a pipeline compared to the total capacity needed in terms of generating capacity. I think we need to put much more effort in terms of renewable energy. We have to get clarity on the new generation regulations in terms of the IPPs, and also securing contracts with the independent producers, which only produces 287 megawatts of electricity supply. But just looking at the bigger picture of what is needed and demand, which is 30,000 megawatts per year, and going up to 38 in winter, and then we come to the reserve margins, I think we have to put a concerted effort, and if it's possible, that renewable energy, that we perhaps up the target of 16%, but then we have to come up with different plans and perhaps just your views on how we can reach this target. My second point would be on the funding model for nuclear. Yes, we also had the privilege to be in France, and Areva indicated to us that they have a funding model available for government, and that it's just a phone call away, as to say, and they would be very pleased to oblige in terms of constructing 6 nuclear plants in the country. That was the promise made. It's strange to me then that we have a funding model for no nuclear, which of course we have to look at, but I don't know how feasible that is, and I would like to perhaps have more information regarding that. Because if we look at the energy supply, and which is far from reliable and sustainable at present, and we had the announcement of Eskom from Mr. Damas that load shedding is a reality, or could be a reality again, that was a different scenario as what we had in June when we discussed the IRP2, we have to look at supply adequacy, and that should be a huge focus point. So I'm quite concerned. We look at renewable energy that doesn't seem to come off the mark. We have a funding model for nuclear, but we have now a model for no nuclear, and I think we need to have some guidance in terms of supply adequacy, and time is definitely of the essence if you look at the reality of the present situation. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I have a couple of questions, some around the process and some around the substance of the IRP2. The first one on the process, I mean, I hear your pain around public participation. It's a difficult process, I know that. And when you receive 5,000 comments, I know it's very difficult to process all of that. But I think what that does demonstrate, though, is that 5,000 comments, it comes from South Africans that are very interested in this particular issue. And I think that if we stuck to the original timetable without the Deputy President's push to actually extend this, we would have lost a lot of those comments. We would have lost what is extremely important in terms of developing a 20-year energy plan. So I think it is vital that we get public participation right on this particular energy plan. And I think on that basis, though, I mean, of the initial 871 comments that were received by your department on the IRP2, one of the complaints that has been raised is that 61% of those comments, in fact, have received no response. And it's not enough to say that you're capturing all of the comments. You also have to give some indication that you have considered these comments and that you have given some kind of response to that. Because I think, you know, you're also starting off from a very poor base in terms of your technical advisory panel having been constituted of essentially that minerals energy complex that you talked about. So, of course, there is a lot of cynicism around the public participation process, and therefore the emphasis needs to come from your side to show that you are taking very seriously the comments that are received from ordinary South Africans and that you are actually using those ones that can be useful in terms of your planning process. So that's just my initial comments with regard to the participation process. Then the other issues, I mean, the externalities. You know, the problem with the externalities is that when we look at the low-cost scenario, if we look at what's the lowest cost to South Africa, it's not just a financial cost. I mean, it's a cost to society as a whole. That's clearly what we want to be modeling here. It's not just how much rand and cents is it going to cost us in terms of actual investment. It's also how much is this going to cost our society as a whole over the next 20 years. And unfortunately, we don't have that externality study. I know the difficulties involved in that, but I asked this question 4 years ago to the department, where's the externalities of energy study? And it hasn't been completed yet. So we are working off a very poor base. We don't know the true externalities of different energy sources in this country, and it makes it very difficult to do a proper modeling study in that regard. But, you know, those are the constraints we're working, so we're going to have to make as best as we can. In terms of the targets that you've given, I mean, you say 16% now of renewables by 2030. It's interesting to me to read the South African Renewables Initiative document, which is being a joint document with the Department of Trade and Industry, as well as with the Department of Public Enterprises. And what they're looking to do is to reach a 15% renewable energy target by 2020, which they feel is doable. Have you looked at their particular modeling? Have you looked at what they're putting forward there? And I recognize that there is certain additional costs that are involved in this. But that is money that could be raised. We could look at funding models from outside, and that is precisely what they are doing. And if we can reach the 15% target by 2020, that's the building block. We've got the industry then to reach a target of at least about 50% by 2030. And this is what we should be trying to model in there. I mean, let's look at what is possible, and let's look at how we can obtain some of these particular targets. And then something which hasn't been talked about very much, but which I think is absolutely crucial in terms of the IRP2, is energy efficiency. And why is it that we've given so little to energy efficiency in this IRP2? You talk about a figure of, I think it's 3,420 megawatts by 2030. Now, this is about a quarter of what is potential in South Africa. We could at least reach about 13,000, or let's say 12,000 megawatts by 2030. That brings down our demand substantially, which means that we can then increase the amount of renewables in terms of that particular equation. And so when you look at, for instance, your low emission scenario, and you say that you have to have nuclear, if you in fact include energy efficiency in that, I don't know, I think that that will possibly change as well. So those are things we need to look at. I mean, I have other issues, but I will wait till later to bring up some of those as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chairperson. I think this morning we started the year well, and I hope we continue in this vein. And we need to go forward. We need to go forward. I think what we can see from today is that the emissions and climate change, the effect it's having on our country at the moment. Look at the excess of water. We talk about water shortages, and there's water all over. And we need to do something about these things, even in the water angle, of looking ahead. We sit here, all this water is getting blown away. It could have been saved. But I'm pleased that you'll have started on the water heating process, because that's one of my oldest gripes, that every time I've reported, I've spoken about it, and how it could be a fundamental way of saving the system. And please, if we could continue to the other parts of South Africa, not only Gauteng and Cape Town. The very interesting issue is nuclear. I think we need to look at this, and we need to be need to get our people educated on what is happening, because we argue with half facts. We sometimes, really, sometimes simply because we do not know. And we are the people who are supposed to be taking serious decisions. So we need to look at this, the effects of nuclear, what do it do, and the results. And at the last meeting we had with the nuclear people, they were talking about recycling. But the waste is still not completely taken away. There's still 4 to 5% which is there, which is this danger. And when you talk about nuclear, we close off completely and we say, it is dangerous because blah, 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 blah. And I think we need a serious educational process so that we can all understand exactly what has happened. Coal, yes, it's dangerous, it's got it. Got its shortfalls. However, that is what we have on the ground. I don't know how we can completely just say, no, we don't use coal. The couple of last year, we had a German politician who represents the Green Party, and he just said, stop using coal. And the joke is that they're importing the coal from us. They are using the coal in Germany. And he had the audacity to stand up boldly and say, stop using it. So I think, but they implement technology. And that's what we should be doing. We should be seeing what technologies can we do to lessen the emission effect. And if we do that, we can go forward. Because we all say we need a solution. And South Africans are the first one to say, we need a solution. Therefore, we're sitting like this here because we are serious about it. And hopefully we can go forward. Unfortunately, electricity cannot be dammed like water, especially AC, because it is just impossible. So this pump, yes, it could work to a certain extent, but I don't think it can really, really go to the great extent. It is sort of a stopgap sort of issue. But our electricity issue is serious. Mr. Chairman, I hope we pay more attention to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Members. Surely it's time to give the Department a chance to have a breather, look at the questions and prepare to respond to them. Can you take a 5-minute break? Thank you. Thank you.